This podcast is a production of KCRW and KCRW.com Santa Monica. If you enjoy this program, check out KCRW.com for more than 20 additional programs that you can podcast.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Klobrodesser Achner, and this is The Business.
So you still want to do the show business, and you think that you got what it takes? I mean, you really got to rap and be all that. Prepare yourself for the breaks. Check it out.
This week on The Business, the writer's strike will affect everyone in Hollywood in the long run, but broadcast television is already feeling the effects, and it's likely to change TV forever. Today, we talk to two former network heads about what the strike means to you and your favorite shows now and in the future. Stick around. It's The Business from NPR. The movie business is somewhat insulated from the immediate effect of the writer's strike, since films for next year are more or less on their way to being in the can. Though without Jay and Dave and Conan, the studios have lost one of their main places for free promotion. For television, aside from the immediate disappearances of the late-night talkers, the common wisdom was that the real effects of the strike wouldn't be felt until around January, when the scripted shows ran out of episodes. But many of the showrunners, those producer-writer hybrids, have walked off the set with their writers, and that means those shows will go black sooner than expected. For instance, Variety reports that The New Adventures of Old Christine and Back to You probably won't be Back to You until the writers are back at their computers. In the first part of today's show, we're going to talk about the strike, how the networks are preparing to survive it, and which network is in the best position to handle it long term. Later in the show, we'll talk about the changes to TV that were underway well before the strike. Our host, Klobrodesser Achner, talked to Dean Valentine, who was head of the now-defunct UPN network in the late 90s. Jordan Levin joined the now-defunct WB network before its 1995 launch and rose through the programming ranks to become president.
Dean Valentine, Jordan Levin, welcome to The Business. Welcome back, I should say.
Thank you. Always a pleasure to be here.
We're in the midst of this Hollywood writer's strike. Are we arguing over what is or what could be when we're talking about revenue from digital? Dean?
Well, we're arguing over what was and what is and what will be.
Explain that.
Well, what was is the writers have been frustrated, enraged, angry since 1988 when they felt that they were screwed on the DVD residual business by Lou Wasserman.
That's what was.
They've been increasingly angry as they've watched these companies make, to their minds, more and more money. They want more of it. The companies have, in fact, made more money. And that's what is. And what will be is it's clear that content is migrating digitally. And they want a piece of that. And that is what will be.
Jordan, I mean, when we're talking about here with the writers, are they on strike for what is or what will be?
I agree with Dean. I mean, it is what was, what is, and what will be. But from the standpoint of what will be, there's no doubt there's going to be something. You know, we're still very early stage, but you have to remember that back in 1988, that was rather early stage for the home video business. And so what the writers are trying to avoid is getting in a situation like they got into last time, where they agreed to take a beat with these studios and not push aggressively for home video revenues, and then saw those revenues blossom. They don't want to make the same mistake again. And, you know, what you hear from the picket lines and from writers is that they recognize that they're going to suffer from this strike and they aren't going to see these revenues in the short term, but long term they're doing it for the next generation so that what happened to them doesn't happen again.
Yeah, and also let's not be overly coy about it like the studios are being. There is revenue being made in the digital space by the studios. It may not be a lot right now. It's all shaking out, but they're selling their shows on iTunes. They're selling them online. They're selling advertising against these shows. There's actual revenue coming in, and when you sort of think about it from the cost standpoint, the studios have zero cost for this content. In other words, they're taking something that was already made, that was already distributed on, you know, on broadcast TV or cable or wherever it was or internationally, and they're putting it on digital, and it's free to them. And for that, they're getting $2 or $3 or $5 per download, or whatever amount they're getting in advertising or will get in advertising, because the advertising part of it is much more complicated. But there will be advertising against it, like as in Hulu and stuff like that. You know,
you're talking about Hulu, the joint venture between Fox and NBC to sort of replace their deal with iTunes.
Exactly. And so it's clear there's going to be some revenue against this sort of content. And so whatever that amount is, the writers are simply saying that they want some formula for participating in it that is not as damaging to them as the 1988 formulas. I think it's a legitimate, personally, I think it's a legitimate legitimate request.
What do networks do to prepare for a strike, and what do they do during a strike to survive? Jordan?
Well, back in 2000, you know, each of us, Dean and myself and others in network seats, we all prepared by trying to invest as heavily as we could in reality, by trying to stockpile as many scripted programs or episodes as we could. You know, these companies are all now part of much larger conglomerates, and so they can weather the storm to a much greater degree than, you know, the networks could in 1988. But to the degree that you can prepare, and what you can do is try and look at your schedule and figure out where there's going to be windows of opportunity. You know, you saw in 1988, for example, the Fox network benefited from the strike tremendously because it was a new network. People had yet to discover some of their programs, and even though those programs were in repeats, Married with Children really took off during that 88 strike. And then, of course, you know, basic cable really attracted a serious audience share for the first time.
It's interesting what you say about Fox, because I remember living in China, and one of my students said, I said, what's the best way to learn how to use chopsticks? And he said, well, the best way to learn is to be hungry and not have a fork. and it sounds like that's the same maxim sort of applies to programming, that nothing looks better than a show that you never would have seen except when there's nothing else to watch.
To that point, I think it's worth noting that even the most rabid fan of any series usually tends to watch only two or three episodes. And what that means is that there's constant sampling going on in television, much more than we think. We just have this idea, somebody watches a show, they're watching it every week, and that's just the way it is. It's really not the way it is. What's happening is people are going in and out of shows on a constant basis. So when there is no new production going on, that trend is going to accelerate. So you're going to see, for at least for the first 6 months or so, if the strike lasts that long, you're going to see an enormous amount of more sampling. People going around who are fans of this show kind of going, oh, let me check out this thing.
Never watched Heroes. Maybe I'll try it.
Exactly.
So do repeats work? I guess in that sense they do, right?
Some repeats work better than other repeats. Highly serialized shows tend not to work.
Explain what you mean when you say that.
Highly serialized is a story that continues for 22 episodes. And the more you have to be there for every episode to follow the story, the harder it is to get into it.
But, you know, you're dealing with a much different environment, though, now from the standpoint of what defines a hit and what defines success. Because, you know, even in the last 10 years, this separation between shows that work and shows that don't work has only grown bigger. So there's a whole dynamic at work here for the first time that wasn't at work in 88 or wasn't even at work as much in 2000.
What do you mean by that,
Jordan? Which is you have shows that are hits. Mm-hmm. The people are going to probably come back to. The life cycle of those hits don't last as long as they used to. So even very popular shows like Lost and Desperate Housewives, and even newer shows like Ugly Betty that were labeled hits, have shown some erosion this season. Now, whether that erosion is a result of some of the new Nielsen recalibration of their data and new measurement standards, or whether that is a function of increasingly fragmented marketplace, is for a whole separate conversation. But from the standpoint of shows that have lost audience year to year, being off the air for as long as they're going to be off the air could accelerate that trend. And then you have a number of shows that in the past we used to say were singles or doubles, and those would just sort of chug along. They were never hits, but they were workmanlike and they would do their job. Now those shows, you know, are fighting desperately.
They call it shows on the bubble.
On the bubble. And shows on the bubble are going to, you know, suffer substantially, not just from viewer erosion, but they could suffer from the standpoint that the studios and or the networks, which in many cases are one and the same entity now under one big umbrella, you know, look at those programs and say, let's cut our losses and wrap it. And I think you're going to see a lot of, you know, shows at this point and before they really even began.
If you're just joining us, the Business host Claude Brodesser-Ackner is speaking with Jordan Levin, former head of the WB network, and Dean Valentine, former head of UPN, about how the TV networks are dealing with the current writer's strike.
To my experience, guys like you always have to worry about next quarter. What does my quarter look like? You always have some guy in New York on the phone with you saying, what does the next quarter look like?
I missed that, Dean. That was fun, huh?
Oh, it was great.
The look on both of your faces is just like it's a bad dream. Do you then have to sort of focus on sort of ordering shows from overseas, or do you, Dean?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it starts with a contingency strike plan. We'll start with the strong shows you have, trying to get as many episodes in the can as you can of that show. So you'll devote as many resources as you can to making that happen. Then it'll be the next group of shows that you think have some promise, and maybe they're not there yet. You'll try to get as many episodes of that show as you can in the can. But, and then you'll start looking at alternative programming. Alternative programming will range anywhere from a reality show, which obviously don't require the same level of writing or any writing at all, to looking abroad, to looking at shows that are where the scripts already exist or in English-speaking countries, and you think you might just be able to film those shows. So you just kind of keep going through increasingly more speculative programming. But that's really what is happening at every network now. It's what's been going on probably for the last, like, 4 months, that would be my guess. And at some point, if the strike lasts long enough, all those will run their course. And that will be sometime when the middle of pilot season in February, March. If the strike isn't settled by February, March, that impacts the entire next year. And that is that's going to just upset the apple cart in a major, major way.
Jordan?
Well, I think you'll start seeing shows run out of episodes by... Oh, no, I know you're saying. I just wanted to clarify.
Yeah.
You're going to see shows start to run out of episodes around January of the scripted shows. I mean, right now, I would think most shows are only a couple scripts ahead, maybe six scripts ahead at the most. Production maybe two or three episodes ahead, because there's such a squeeze that comes as you approach November in the fall. But you're going to start seeing the impact in terms of fresh episodes, even reality, because there's only so much you can stockpile by early first quarter. What Dean was alluding to that does start to get very interesting is what happens when pilot season starts to really break down, and what do you do if you're a network and you're used to presenting an upfront schedule to advertisers in May? I think the interesting opportunity here may be to start to see a system that everyone in this industry has admitted is broken for a long time start to unravel, and that is the traditional upfront season coupled with an upfront marketplace and the traditional fall schedule.
So we need to give some definitions here for people who don't know what the upfronts are. Basically, it's a $9 billion sort of auction when all the networks come forward and say, here's what we got, and then sort of Madison Avenue lines up and says, I'll take it, you know, I'll take two Desperate Housewives.
Right. It's where they sell 40 to 70% of their advertising inventory for the year and or more.
And that happens in March, right?
Well, it happens in May, the presentations happen. There are big song and dances that, you know, people do in New York and spend a lot of money unveiling a schedule. And in the past, those schedules held and most of that ad money held. But what's happened over the last decade is really that advertising is calls on the marketplace to some degree that advertisers can back out of very close to the time that those shows actually air. So it's a much more fluid marketplace. There's no real teeth in any of those upfront deals. And on top of that, you see network schedules become extremely fluid, you know, over time, where the shows that they announce in May more often than not don't always appear the way those schedules were pitched come fall. So the degree to which we don't see a fall schedule that we're normally used to seeing becomes really interesting. I think this may give the impetus to say, let's not do this anymore. And I think that will get underlined by the fact that Fox, which is traditionally a player that doesn't launch strong until first quarter, probably out of all the networks right now is in the best position, not only because they have American Idol, but because they've been saving their shows for a January launch.
Well, I want to get into all of that right now, actually, because I want to sort of tick through the list of networks, and let's talk about who's in the best position and who's in the worst. And it sounds like what Jordan's saying is that Fox is by far in the best position. We should also point out that they have fewer hours of primetime programming to program, and half of that is reality programming.
That's right. They have fewer hours. They have American Idol coming back. They're just in a much, much stronger position. They have, you know, they traditionally do the baseball World Series and the playoffs, and that pushes their launch dates into November, December, January, which is what's happened this year. In this case, it's going to be a tremendous boon. They will, if the strike goes on, they will benefit by far the most.
ABC, for instance.
ABC is also in a reasonably strong position. They have a lot of very strong shows to begin with in the top 20. I think they have the largest percentage of shows in the top 20. A lot of those are reality shows, and a lot of the shows are strong shows that people like. So they will be able to hold on longer. People will come back more for the repeats.
Now, Desperate Housewives and Grey's Anatomy are not shows that repeat terribly well for them,
no,
right?
No, but other shows are. And they have some new shows that have a little bit of heat, Samantha Who and some of that.
Dirty Sexy Money.
Yeah, and those will probably get some sampling. So I think they're just by the nature of the strength of their schedule and the quality of their programming, they're in a better position.
Now, Jordan, let's talk about what ultimately became your parent company, which swallowed the WB, CBS. What CBS sort of has, in some respects, the worst luck here, because not only do they have a lot of shows that are sort of on the bubble, as we were talking about earlier, that sort of need to connect with an audience time and again, they also don't have a sort of corporate ownership structure the same way that other...
I think that's the biggest risk for CBS overall as an entity is it's the least diversified. It's the most dependent upon advertising. So when you look at ABC or Fox, you know, with News Corp, ABC with Disney, you know, NBC, which whose parent's company is GE, they can really weather the storm to a greater degree than CBS, which has both the CBS network and half ownership of the CW. So they're probably the most susceptible to a strike. In regards to CBS, on the other hand, they do have the oldest audience out of any network. So that's probably the audience that is most likely to continue to watch a number of those shows in repeat. And the shows that are their strongest shows are more franchise-based shows, which as compared to the serialized dramas that Dean referenced that are open-ended storytelling, soap operas, these more closed-ended, puzzle-formatted, you know, mystery shows will repeat fairly well. So
an older audience is probably far less likely to, say, go on the web and say, oh, I'll spend my time looking at TMZ instead of watching, you know, The Unit.
And CBS has a fair amount of sports also. And
but we should talk about the CW because that's a very interesting story. They're probably more dependent than any other network at this point in time, you know, on scripted programming from a percentage of their schedule. Obviously, they have less of a schedule to program than the other networks, but they merged with programs that were aging. They're in a challenged financial position. They have the youngest audience, which is most susceptible to leaving anyhow. Most of their programming is serialized, you know, and whether or not a network like that honestly can survive a long strike within a parent company like CBS that already has undue pressure because it isn't as diversified as others is going to be a real story to watch.
If I had to pick the network that is in the worst shape, not including our former employers, it would be NBC. The programming is the worst. It's a really, really weak schedule. It's been weakening for 3-4 years. Every year you don't really put on a great, successful show is another year that you deteriorate much more aggressively. So for them, it's all about next year. And they will be the most damaged if the strike goes on beyond some small short period of time, of a month or 2 months, they're going to be the most damaged because they're the ones most counting on original programming and on programming to pull their way out of the slump that they're in.
Well, I would say one thing. What's going to be interesting to watch is their new head of entertainment, Ben Silverman, who is a wunderkind producer who was very responsible for this reality revolution that occurred around 2000, you know, Ben imported on behalf of William Morris Agency, you know, Who Wants to Be a Millionaire and other shows like that. He's been charged with, you know, really shaking up the entire way that NBC looks at the business. And this should give him an open door to say, okay, now how creative can you really be tapping international relationships and formats? Sort of takes whatever corporate restraints I think were potentially imposed on Ben and says, do whatever you can.
After a short break, more with former network heads Dean Valentine and Jordan Levin about the writer's strike and the future of television. The strike is on everyone's mind, but TV was changing well before the writers walked off the job last Monday. You're listening to The Business from NPR.
You're listening to The Business, and I'm Matt Holzman, sitting in for Claude Brodesser-Ackner. Everyone in Hollywood is talking about what the writer's strike means for television, but the TV industry was struggling with a painful transmogrification well before the writers walked off the job last Monday. As one of today's guests so eloquently put it, the strike is not so much a catalyst for change, but a reaction to it. Broadcast TV viewership has vastly declined since its heyday, mostly because there are so many more entertainment options. Cable, movie DVDs, the web, video games, even reading. DVDs of TV shows, DVRs, and iPods have put the control of when to watch shows and whether or not to watch commercials in the hands of viewers. Our host Claude Brodesser-Ackner spoke with two guys who have been where TV was and are leading the way to where it's going. Jordan Levin joined the now-defunct WB Network before its January 1995 launch as part of the founding executive team and rose through the programming ranks to become president. He went on to found Generate, a cross-platform production and management company. Dean Valentine was a longtime TV exec who became head of the now-defunct UPN Network in the late 90s. He's gone on to found Symbolic Action, a media investment firm with a digital orientation.
I want to talk about the last strike and where we are now. And obviously, it is a totally different universe. Back in 1988, there were just 20 or so cable channels. Now the average home has about 100. Obviously, there's broadband penetration into so many households. There's DVRs now. You know, it's like 20%. It's supposed to be like about a third, I think, of the nation by the end of next year. Also, in terms of total reach of a program compared, you know, with the late 80s and now, in 1988, The Cosby Show reached, I think, 25% of U.S. homes with TV. CSI and Grey's Anatomy now only reached 13%, which, you know, those are the biggest shows on television. What are the stopgap measures that can still be applied and what no longer applies? Dean?
I guess I would say I think it's a it's part of a larger problem for these large media companies, which is that their core business, their fundamental core business, which is a distribution business, has been deteriorating for the last 5-6 years when the internet broadband pipes lit up. And that process is going to continue. There is nothing that is going to make it better. Nothing. It's only going to get worse. And that is the real problem that they face. It's what they're afraid of, and it's part of their recalcitrance and their resistance to the writers' demands. That they're looking down the road and all they see is a Wile E. Coyote precipice. Mm-hmm. And that's really the problem that they have. So there's nothing they can do. Ultimately, their market share is going to erode, and the only thing they can do to revive their business or to make their business make some sense to Wall Street and to themselves is to radically cut costs. And that's really the problem that they're facing.
So given that television is in such lousy shape, the economics of the business are cuckoo, why wouldn't that incentivize both sides to make a deal here and not go through these horrible sort of machinations on the rack? It just seems like a needless torture that both sides shouldn't want to go through. Jordan?
You know, I think the larger issue is, you know, to Dean's point, you know, this is an industry in massive disruption. And what happened in the music industry is happening to the larger media industry as a whole. And the answers are not clear. So you have people being asked on either side to make decisions when you don't know what the consequences of those decisions are, but based on past behavior, you have on the one side an industry in retreat and defense mode trying to figure out how to maintain some control in a world that is increasingly out of their control. And then you have a group of creators who in the past, by not seizing more control, gave up a lot of opportunity and not wanting to go through that again. And I think while the short-term orientation of the media companies are that sort of quarterly pressure that Wall Street applies to them, you do have this larger pressure weighing on the writers, which seems to be, again, a much greater conflict at work here. What is right and what is wrong for them? There's a deep-seated anger. There's a deep-seated emotion here that's very hard to bring to the bargaining table over what is essentially a smaller pie. I mean, no one's going to be happy with the outcome of this. No one's going to win from this. There's still a pie there that is valuable and can create opportunities for people. But that pie's getting smaller, and everyone's fighting over what is increasingly more and more slices of that pie.
I want to address that and ask you, Dean, since you were very much around and in the thick of this in 88 when it went down the last time, TV viewership dropped overall 8% during the last strike.
Right.
Now, admittedly, that's 20 years ago.
Right.
A lot of the beneficiary was cable television, which was under a totally different contract back then. That's not the case now.
Right.
Any predictions this time around about what's going to happen and when this is over, who, if anyone, might be coming back?
Well, it depends, first of all, how long it lasts. And second of all, it depends on what you mean by dropping in viewership. I mean, if you're looking at the total pie of cable and network television, my guess is that you won't start seeing significant drop-offs in viewership for many months. It just takes a lot longer for that to happen than you would think. And so, no, I don't think people will see it for a while. When it does happen, it'll happen precipitously and it'll happen deeply. I think, you know, I wouldn't be surprised to see a, you know, 5 to 10% decline across the whole spectrum of cable and network, which is really a significant number. And it could even be bigger. People have a lot of choices now, and they didn't have those choices then.
That would be, to put it in economic terms, almost a $1 billion erosion of advertising.
Well, the erosion could be greater. I mean, if you sort of look at what's actually going to happen is the networks are going to show up in May with a bunch of inventory to sell to advertisers. If they don't have any new shows, they don't really have any inventory to sell to advertisers. They have inventory in old shows. So an advertiser is going to be sitting there, and you're going to walk into the guy who represents Ford going, you know, I'd like you to buy my spot in the 18th repeat of CSI. And the answer will be, sure, I'll buy it. I'll buy it for $1.25 CPM as opposed to $25. So for the networks, the impact, the financial impact is far, far greater and extends for a far, far deeper period just because of the way network buys happen. The way the money comes into networks is profoundly impacted by the upfront. And if that is affected, it's going to have profound impacts on the network and their ability to finance new shows as well.
And that's where this really gets interesting, right? You know, it wasn't readily clear in 1988 or 1989 or the early part of the 90s that the beneficiary of the 88 strike was really this migration of audience from broadcast to cable. It took a while to recognize that. I think many people believe that looking back on whatever happens during this period of time, that the net effect will be a large migration to digital. While there's been a lot of debate about whether or not audiences are going to migrate to digital, the earliest constituencies that are going to be forced to migrate to digital are going to be the media buyers. The media buyers who have always looked to some degree at digital as both an opportunity and a challenge because it's much more complicated than a simple television buy are going to be forced to go into the digital marketplace to reach consumers. If you're a movie company advertising your holiday movies this fall, where are you going to go? You're not going to go to broadcast TV the way you went to. There's going to be a lot of money flowing into that marketplace, and that may be what legitimizes digital more than audiences going to digital is the ad dollars that are going to result.
Jordan, you get the last word. Jordan Levin is the former head of the WB. He went on to found Generate, a management and cross-platform agnostic content company, which is a mouthful on any good day. Jordan, thanks for being on The Business.
You bet.
Dean Valentine is the former head of the UPN. He is now the president of Symbolic Action, an online media investment and production company. Dean, thanks for being on The Business.
A postscript. Jordan Levin has been out on the road raising money for his production company, Generate. He says that investors have not been scared off by the strike. In fact, quite the contrary. According to him, they see disruptions like this one as creating business opportunities. Perhaps the broadcast networks should think about that. And that's The Business. Matt Holzman produced and edited today's program. Hey, that's me. With production assistance from Ray Guarna. Our associate producer is Darby Maloney. You can listen to this or any past program online anytime at kcrw.com/thebusiness. You can also podcast the show on KCRW's site or through iTunes. Our email is thebusiness@kcrw.org. The Business is produced by KCRW Santa Monica and distributed by National Public Radio. I'm Matt Holzman. We'll see you next week on The Business.
Support for NPR podcasts comes from Acura, featuring the TL Type S with a 286-horsepower V6 and real-time traffic alerts. Learn more at Acura.com.